there just seems to be a concerted effort to try and get as few people out to the polls as possible. And particularly, persons with disabilities face some really big hurdles to getting involved in their community, especially in politics. And that's one of the things that I've been highlighting as a blind person.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, the crazy idea of an atheist running for Congress. I ask a guest to tell me about his issues. And Bo gets schooled on the subject of the Sunday Assembly. All coming up on this episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and it's good to be back for another episode of the Humanist Hour. This episode, if you like politics, it is for you. But before we get into the political aspect of it, I want to talk a little bit about some research. Many of the guests that we have on the show do cite different research, and it might confuse the listeners, I thought, because there are so many statistics out there about atheists and who is an atheist and what percentage and how many people go to church and so forth. There's just a lot of numbers out there, and the numbers change, obviously, based on new different surveys, different methodology, different organizations doing the research, and of course, different time frames when the research was actually done. One of the common statistics out there is that atheists make up about 2.4% of the population. And that is probably, that's probably the lowest number when it comes to non-believers. And that is, they got that number strictly by defining atheist. Like, are you an atheist? That's how the question is essentially worded. And of course, there are many people who don't believe in God who don't even know what an atheist is. That's just common knowledge. There are also many people who are atheists that really don't like the term and don't like to refer to themselves as atheists because it's more of an identity than just the actual fact of not believing in any gods. So if the question is asked, are you an atheist, you're going to get a very low percent, and that's what we find, although that percent has been increasing. It more than doubled since the last survey, but of course when we go from like 1.2% to 2.4, we're not really going to have a big party about that doubling. Now, on the other end of this spectrum, one of the more recent surveys that came out asked people how often they attend church services. And one of the responses, the possible responses, was that they only attend church services for weddings or funerals. Essentially, they don't go to church. And many people have taken that to mean that these people are functionally atheists. And in one sense, you could say that. I mean, they're the kind of people who are not going to really side with the political right when it comes to Christianity and Christian and biblical beliefs and so forth. They're almost certainly more likely to be more liberal in that area. However, it's not guaranteed. And you certainly cannot jump to the conclusion that these people who just don't go to church don't believe in God, because there are many people out there who consider themselves very spiritual and have their own personal relationship with God. And some of them are even more extreme about their views than people who go to church on a regular basis. They just believe that it's all about a personal relationship. So I really don't think it's fair to use that statistic about church as an accurate indicator of how many people are non-believers, whether you call them atheists, agnostics, non-believers, humanists, whatever. Basically, if Inigo Montoya were here, he would say, "You keep saying that statistic. I do not think that statistic means what you think it means." So I just wanted to caution our listeners when they hear that number. And keep in mind what it actually means and what it doesn't mean. And it's about 43%, somewhere around there, so it's pretty impressive. Even more impressive with a younger demographic. All right, now that that's out of the way, let's talk a little bit about today's show and our guest. Our guest is Mr. James Woods, and he is running for Congress in Arizona. And he's an atheist. That's right, an atheist, and he's running for Congress. His story is pretty amazing, and I don't want to give too much of it away because he talks about it a little bit in the interview, but if you do not get enough and you want to find out more, I strongly suggest Googling his name, James Woods, and I believe there's a popular actor named that as well, so you're going to have to Google James Woods Atheist or James Woods Congress, and you'll find out more information about him. He's got some great YouTube videos as well, so take a look for him there. So here we go, my interview with Mr. James Woods. And I have the pleasure of speaking with Mr. James Woods. How are you, James?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Is it too early to call you Congressman Woods?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. All right, so today is the big day. Today is November 4th, Tuesday. So what is going on today in your part of the world?
Here in Arizona, it is election day, as it is across the United States. And every House district has their election day today, and I am facing the Republican incumbent, Matt Sandman, in Arizona's 5th Congressional District.
And I think it's safe to assume that you are running as a Democrat, correct?
Correct.
And are you the only Democrat running against this Republican?
I believe there is a Libertarian who is also on the ballot this year.
Gotcha. Okay. So is this area where you're actually running, is it mostly Republican as opposed to half and half?
Yes, it is. It's a very conservative district. That has given me an opportunity to run a really audacious progressive campaign, just really presenting the other side and showing that there are other ideas out there and just changing the conversation from the usual rhetoric of the hard right versus the middle of the road candidate. Mm. And I decided to really have a stark contrast between what I believe and what the incumbent believes.
Ah, that's a good strategy. Use the platform to educate without them knowing they're being schooled.
Exactly. And that's why I run as an open atheist and humanist, because someone has to blaze that trail, and if it takes, it's going to take at least a few elections before that whole concept is normalized in this country. As far as I know, I am the first person to run openly as an atheist in a federal election, possibly ever. On a major party's ticket. Hmm.
Well, thank you in advance for doing this and paving the way for all the future atheists who are going to run and have an easier time because you've already been there and done that.
Mm-hmm. In a nation that was founded with enshrining separation of church and state at the very beginning of the Republic.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't quite make sense, does it?
Yeah, despite what some certain revisionists, using historian very loosely, might try and tell you.
Yeah, that's for sure. So have you gotten to the stage yet when your opponent has tried to smear your campaign as being godless?
No, Mr. Sandman is a very shrewd politician. He has been in, this will be his... if he's elected today, this will be his 9th term. And he knows the best way to deal with me was to not even acknowledge my existence. He was specifically asked by our local paper about me recently, and he actually had some very nice, very kind words to say about me. He said that I've run a compelling campaign. He says it's actually, I think the direct quote was something like, the classic conservative himself running against the classic liberal, and it's giving the people in the district a choice. And he feels he represents the, I think what he said is the red complexion of the district better.
Hmm. So do you think he got his vote?
I think he would probably be voting for himself.
Yeah.
But it was classy way to at least acknowledge my existence, and I respect that.
Well, that's good. All right, well, let's talk about your platforms first. First, I got to say that your website is a great website. It's very clear, very easy to understand and follow and click along, so well done on whoever did that job.
Also, it is 100% blind accessible.
Oh.
Which is important, and it's bilingual as well.
That's great. Good to know. All right. So your platforms, I want to read this first one because I think it's just so great, especially the way that it was worded and written. And this has to do with, this is the platform of reason. You wrote, I have a vision for an America in which we approach governance with the best evidence we have available today, not ideology, revelation, or religion. Public policy decisions should be made rationally through an unbiased examination of facts, efficacy, and outcomes. This gives us the best possible chance of steering the country toward the advancement of prosperity for all. We must thoughtfully avoid the unverified opinions and irrational prejudice in our lawmaking process that thwart our common pursuit of happiness. Well done.
Thank you. Yeah, you would think that wouldn't be controversial and would be common sense. But I believe it was Mark Twain who said common sense is remarkably uncommon or something similar to that.
Yeah, common sense is very uncommon. Yeah, it's funny, too, because what you have written makes so much sense to me. And I would think anybody that really does value reason could look at that and say, yes, this makes sense. And it's kind of mind-blowing how anybody could look at that and say, no, that's a terrible idea. I think we should base our policies on something besides reason.
A lot of things that are done in government, especially at the federal level, are done that way because of tradition or what have you. And I think I come from a position that nothing should be accepted on faith. I always like the Royal Society of England's official motto, nullius ad verba, take no one's word. So show your work. Let's see why this is.
Yeah.
There are a lot of policies that have just been instituted and just been moved, just continued because that's the way it's always been done. Well, a lot of things are no longer effective or possibly never were effective.
Yeah, sure. It's the old appeal to tradition fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that if you have faith and you're a person of faith and you like to use faith to navigate your own world, go ahead and do it. But when your faith gets pushed on other people who don't share that faith, then I see a problem.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what are some of the other platforms?
We basically framed everything with five key beliefs.
Okay.
And with it all, any policy decision that I would make would be framed under those five things. And those are equality, reason, compassion, innovation, and sustainability. So any policy that I would advocate for or vote for would have to fall under those categories. And they're explained on the website further, but I think they pretty much speak for themselves.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Mr. James Woods, an atheist running for Congress in Arizona.
Those things are what will allow our society to advance, prosper, and sustain that for as many people as possible.
Sure. Sure. In your description for compassion, you mention this idea of not appealing to special interest or self-interest. And that sounds wonderful, but do you think we could ever get around the problem of politicians being indebted to the interests of their financial supporters?
That is why I'm a big proponent of financial reform. As an underdog candidate, and as basically, I've had tremendous grassroots support. However, it's mostly small donors, and I didn't get super PAC money. Well, I did get some money from the Free Thought Equality PAC, but not to the level of many mainstream congressional candidates.
Gotcha.
The corrupting influence of money is pervasive in politics, but especially at the federal level, because of the recent court decisions in the Supreme Court allowing these opaque groups to take as much money as they want and distribute it however they wish, as, you know, independent expenditures, super PACs, what have you. That has really subverted democracy away from I think it's an original intent, and even how it was a generation ago, it's completely different now. It's all, money has always had influence in politics, obviously, but it is so much more pervasive. I just saw something the other day, I believe it was from the Sunlight Foundation. In the last 3 weeks of the election, $300 million of independent expenditures were spent in congressional races.
Hmm. Wow.
It's a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah.
Here in Arizona, at our state levels, we have a commission that allows candidates to sign a pledge that once they have their signatures collected to get on the ballot, mm-hmm. they can sign a pledge to not take any outside donations. They can only take $5 donations from individuals, and then the state gives them a certain amount depending on how many of those $5 donations they get. So it's partially publicly financed. And I think something similar could be instituted on a national level, but that would require a act of Congress, and there are about 425, 430 members of Congress that like it the way it is just fine now.
Yeah.
Because, they're in entrenched interest, and they've figured out how to make it work for them the way it is now.
Sure. Huh. Something else you have on your website is the statement that we must overcome our resistance to change. And that is another thing that makes perfect sense. But isn't that the very antithesis of conservatism?
Yes, that's why I'm a progressive.
Very good. How might a conservative opponent look at that stance and say something against it?
They, like you said, they'd make an appeal to tradition, abandoning our principles, what have you. Yeah. I think it's a spurious argument and a logical fallacy. People have a hesitance to try things new in general. People are very much fall into that. Well, it's the old saying, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't,
right.
I guess.
Right.
And that's unfortunate because I think that really does stagnate both government and society as a whole. It's the status quo bias. They prefer to keep things as they are, and even if they're not happy with it, rather than risk changing and possibly finding out the result is worse.
Yeah.
But which I would counter, then you just change it again.
Hmm. All right, let's talk a little bit about equality. Now, obviously, you're pro-equality, but from your perspective, is there a difference between equality and, say, equal opportunity?
Yes. Equality is, I would say, it's a broader concept than that.
Okay.
There's the example that gets used a lot is, say, there's an obstacle, and there's people who need to see over the obstacle, and none of them are tall enough to see over. Well, equality would be giving everyone a step stool that was the same height, right?
Right.
So that would allow some people to see over easily, and some people still couldn't see over. That would be equal, or that would be equitable. But I think equality should give a higher boost to the people who need more help. That's why the empowerment programs such as, food stamps, unemployment insurance, tuition waivers for underprivileged groups, things like that. Some people need more help because of either like institutional biases in our culture or past histories or whatever, what have you. There needs to be, having a more equal society will come through helping the least privileged among us.
Right. Yeah, this has always been a tough issue for me. Because on the one hand, I could definitely see how we are agents who can bring about change, and if we want something, we have to work for it, and we need to go for it, and that all makes perfect sense. I understand that. But I also understand that we are really influenced by our biology and by our environment, and our histories have a lot to do with who we are, how we were born, where we were born, how we were brought up, how we were raised. There are so many issues involved in the type of person that we become. And I could see how this whole issue can be a very tricky one.
It is. And it's like saying, well, everyone has access to the library because, you know, everyone can just get up those stairs. Well, what if you're in a wheelchair? A progressive would say, why don't we just have a ramp or put it on the ground, not have stairs at all? That would be the difference, because that's just as equal, but actually more equal, because everyone has access, even despite disability or other disadvantage.
Right, right. You know, I heard this argument once, and it bothered me because it's one of those arguments where on the surface, at first read, it seems like a rational, reasonable argument, but really, once you get into it, it's not. And this had to do with gay marriage. Somebody said that gay people have the same right as straight people to get married to someone of the opposite sex. So they're trying to say that, look, they have the same exact rights. There's no inequality of rights here. But if you think about that argument, it's a pretty bad argument. Just it's a straw man, basically, because if we look at when we had slavery, we could say that, you know, blacks have the same right as whites to buy and own slaves. That's not the question.
It's a perfect straw man. It's making the argument that fighting the argument that no one is making.
Right, right. It's the right in question here isn't the right to be owned, like with slavery or with gay marriage. The right in question is the right to marry a person of the sex to whom you're romantically and sexually attracted. That's the right that they don't have.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if you can't really address the argument, you just change the argument, and there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Change it to something that nobody's actually arguing.
Exactly. Which,
yeah.
Unfortunately, it's a very common political tactic.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you got to play the game, though, right? Have you found yourself doing a lot of that, playing the political game more than you would normally as a rational thinker?
I have been very fortunate. The way I present myself is, I take my honest position, and then I will massage the language to present it in the most palatable way possible. I don't lie through omission, and I don't lie, but sometimes it's just all in how you phrase things.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, if I was talking to a conservative person, and I was talking about same-sex marriage, what I would say and what I would appeal to them with is their right of contract. And that's we'll see that on my policy statements if you're looking at it. I believe any two adults with legal standing should be able to be married, because it's not up to the state to decide what the context marriage should take is. As long as two people have the legal right to enter into a marriage contract, they should be able to do it with whomever they wish.
Right. Yeah,
that's the libertarian argument for same-sex marriage.
Yeah, that seems tough. The tough part is to really get a message across in a passionate way, while sticking to the validity of the argument itself, without veering off into this land where you have to massage the argument in such a way that it might be more palatable to people who normally wouldn't accept the argument based on the facts itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you got a good strategy there, a good balance, and I hope it works for you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's unfortunate, and it's very true. People tend to make the decisions emotionally, and then will backfill intellectual justification for it.
Mm.
So you have to use emotional language and then back it up with facts, rather than, which is the way Democrats normally do it, is start with the facts and then hopefully make an emotional appeal at the end.
Yeah,
I think they do. I think that's the common way it's done in the left-leaning political sphere, and I think that is the wrong way to look at it. Republicans are great at messaging. They make the emotional appeal, then sometimes they don't even back it up with facts. They just make an emotional appeal and then repeat it, and they drive the message home. And all of their candidates are all on message all the time and repeating the same talking points. And that repetition gets in people's heads. And you'll even notice on certain issues, even Democrats will start using their language to refer to these issues. And if you're defining the conversation, you're winning.
Right, right. All right, so let's talk about some of your issues. That doesn't sound right. Let's talk about some of the political issues on which you're campaigning. Or more specifically, some of the issues related to humanism. First of all, before we get into that, I want to ask your thoughts on this idea of having humanism being recognized as a religion. Have you even heard of that?
Yes, I did. I saw that. I don't know if I'm comfortable with the connotation of it being recognized as a religion. However, that legal status and that legal protection will be good to establish laws, such as like humanist chaplains in the military and things like that. I'm not thrilled with the wording of, you know, referring to it as a religion, but it's good that it's being recognized as a legitimate thing and a legitimate identity that people identify with.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, you probably have the same idea as many other humanists. I think I've heard the same thing being echoed among the community, that it's great that it is getting equal opportunity with other religions, but it's just this whole idea of calling it a religion just kind of leaves a bad taste in all our mouths.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
But if it's a means to an end, you know, then so
yes,
be it.
And that legal protection is definitely a very sought after end. So.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we talked about gay marriage. That's something that you are a big proponent of.
Yes.
What else?
Access to medical care. I think the only real solution, the only equitable, compassionate solution is to have a universal single-payer healthcare system. Your listeners may or may not be familiar with my story, but in 2006, I was struck down with I had antibiotic-resistant infection, MRSA, also known as the flesh-eating bacteria, in my left clavicle. And because I'm a type 1 diabetic, that caused the infection to rage uncontrollably, and that caused them to have to remove 2 inches of my clavicle, my kidneys to fail, and not quite 2 months later, for me to lose my sight. So then I was on dialysis and blind, and was in the hospital, and I didn't have proper medical care. I didn't have medical insurance. Luckily, I was able to qualify immediately because of my kidney failure for Medicaid and our Medicare and Social Security disability and all of that. So I've made that a key part of my platform is medical care should be a human right. We are the only Western first world country that doesn't have universal health care. And it just makes good economic sense because economies of scale, it would take a huge burden off of employers having to have to pay that medical insurance premium. And having a healthy population is good for the economy. It increases productivity, and it's just the right thing to do. It's the moral and ethical thing to do to support anyone who is sick. It should be a human right, and it's a very humanist position to have. It's a person-first and moral and ethical position.
Right. Wow. Yeah, I can't even imagine going through what you went through, but I have spoken with many people who have been through some kind of medical procedures or treatments and been in the same situation where they were kind of saved by this medical coverage and this health care, and their opinions drastically changed on universal health care after needing it or after having a child that desperately needed it and saved them from bankruptcy. So I guess it's one of those things that most people don't even think about who fortunately don't experience something like that. But we have to keep in mind that there is a significant portion of the population who aren't as fortunate as we are and do run into trouble and do need help.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another thing I tell people, you know, if you don't have a severe medical issue or become disabled in your lifetime, you are one of the lucky few. If you don't have a significant medical problem now, wait a while. You're going to get old.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right. What's another issue about which you are passionate?
Civic engagement. The civic engagement in this country is abysmal. Here in Arizona, we are 46th in voter turnout and dropping. And it seems to be some of that is by design. Arizona is kind of famous for our voter ID law that was passed. And there just seems to be a concerted effort to try and get as few people out to the polls as possible. And particularly persons with disabilities face some really big hurdles to getting involved in their community, especially in politics. And that's one of the things that I've been highlighting as a blind person. Just so whenever I do an event or anything like that, I make a point to be as accessible and accommodating as possible. For example, all of our campaign videos have subtitles for anyone who is hearing impaired, and you can get transcripts also on our website. Someone who's visually impaired, we make sure that all of our videos have the main part of it, the speech, is clearly audible, no background distractions, and again, transcripts and stuff, so that they're accessible that way. Our website is freely accessible for anyone with a visual impairment. Just, I think our democracy is enriched when as many people as possible participate, and that is, I do believe in citizen government, and it should be a government by, of, and for the people. And the only way we can have that is if we can get people involved. And unfortunately, that's not the case now.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. All right, well, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about these voter registration laws and issues. Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we are speaking with Mr. James Woods, an atheist running for Congress. So from what I understand about the voter registration laws is that they are put into place to try to eliminate or at least minimize voting fraud, right? And the issue really is that there is very little voter fraud, or it's pretty much non-existent, but yet it keeps out potentially millions of people who otherwise would most likely vote Democratic, and that's the problem, right?
Exactly. Actually, I just heard a story from a friend of mine named Adam, who is actually he's an attorney. He is a white, middle-class, college-educated, person. But because he's young, he moves frequently, and he is properly registered. He showed up at his proper polling place, and he basically had to get an argument to be allowed to cast a provisional ballot because he had recently moved in the neighborhood and updated his registration just before the deadline set by our Secretary of State. And yes, it does absolutely. It targets the young, the less affluent, and especially minorities, and persons with disabilities just having access to getting to the polls or getting an early ballot or what have you.
I noticed one of your issues has to do with anti-rape positions and policies. Again, reading that one, I can't help but think, who would ever be against this?
Congress didn't reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act, so you can look at their voting record and see exactly who would not support this.
So what is that exactly? Because I didn't get a full picture just from reading your site. I just pretty much got your summary of what you are for. But what is this act, and why would somebody, what is the benefit of reenacting it?
The act specifically adds language. It's similar to hate crime legislation for violence targeting women because women predominantly are the target of domestic violence, both just physical assault and worse, murder. So it makes enforcement stronger for sex acts and also sexual assault and rape as well. And it didn't used to be a controversial bill, but in the political climate we're in now, it was considered to be politically a loser, again, by people on the right. So it was not reauthorized.
Hmm. Mind-blowing, mm-hmm. Some of these things. I bet being an atheist in politics, you've been approached, whether it be by other politicians or just by people on Facebook or something, asking you about the founding fathers. And, well, the founding fathers were religious. So how do you counter that argument?
I said, well, for men of the time, not particularly. And most of them were deists. They believed in sort of like the Aristotelian idea of God, like the primary mover. They were men of the Enlightenment, and even if they were religious, which some of them were, they saw the need for a separation between the church and the state. Then you can see that in their letters. They didn't want the United States to be like old Europe, where the church had influence over the government through the crown. They wanted to start something new with a new secular government separate from the state, but the state and the church, which I wholly support. And I also point them at the Thomas Jefferson Bible, where he took all the acts of the supernatural out of it.
Right.
And I believe it was Madison's letter to that says, this country is in no way founded as a Christian nation to the Treaty of Tripoli that ended the against the Barbary pirates. So.
Right, right. And I bet you educate a lot of people when they ask you about the saying "In God We Trust" and how that's on the money, and the hey,
only since 1953.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. That's a strange case because they're appealing to tradition, but only as far back as 1952 or 53. They're not right. appealing to the older tradition of not having that on our money.
And the way I usually fight that argument, because it's almost always on the internet, is I will send them a YouTube clip of either Bugs Bunny or Porky Pig saying the Pledge of Allegiance without it in it.
Ah.
Because, and you can easily find them because, you know, the Looney Tunes and the Merry Melodies were around in the 30s and 40s. So you just find one of them saying the pledge without it. And like, yeah, that's new.
I bet the response would be, oh, you know what? Well, Porky Pig was just an atheist. That's why.
Yep.
So what's next for you? What? Well, let me ask you, what do you think your chances are?
Well, taking the seat, very low.
Very low. But are we talking about 10%, 1%?
Well, the district's average performance is in the 30% of the vote. It is a relatively new district, but the East Valley is very red. It is very solidly red. But I consider this campaign a victory because I did get to stand up and talk about issues that other politicians are afraid to touch, like separation of church and state, like the role of how there is a de facto bias against people who profess to not have a faith, and the obstacles facing persons with disabilities from getting a lot involved in the political process. Having a pro-woman stances. I support a woman's right to have a safe legal abortion, and that falls nicely into the separation of church and state. I believe in science-based education, and I support same-sex marriage. I've spoken out in support and in both solidarity with the transgender community and against the biases and persecution in some cases that they face. Immigrants' rights. There's lots of things out there. Gun violence is another one. That was another one of the things we did that got a lot of attention was my gun deal. I went to a gun show and purchased a firearm. No ID, no background check, no questions asked. It only cost $100, and I actually argued the dealer down $50.
Oh, jeez.
Wow. Pro-life groups or anti-choice groups, right? We're sending these form letters. They had their local activists send a form letter asking me to sign a pledge that if I was to enter Congress, that I would support fetal personhood bills and just a number of other medically and scientifically inaccurate things. So I drafted a letter and sent it back to them saying that I support your goal of trying to reduce the number of abortions, but I believe the way you're going about it is wrong. I think the most effective way to reduce the number of abortions is through universal access to birth control, community support programs for women, and age-appropriate sexual education. And we had condoms printed with my campaign logo and a hashtag prevent abortion and mailed them back to them.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, that got some attention as well.
That is great. So even if you don't win, you certainly made a lot of waves and hopefully raised the eyebrows of some people and maybe even changed the opinions of some people, or at least gave them something to think about that they might not have thought about before.
Exactly. Giving people a new perspective and changing the conversation was really one of the goals of the campaign. When we first started this, I actually signed my Federal Elections Commission paperwork in my hospital bed the day after I got my kidney transplant. And I was discussing it with my campaign team, who were all there visiting me in the hospital. And I said, this is more than just about one congressional election. This is about building something and for the future. It's blazing a trail for people to be able to run without having to profess a belief in God, or at least being able to run honestly as a non-theist, and to talk about things that most politicians are too afraid to talk about. And that was why I decided to run in, because I had the option to run in a local election at the state level, but I probably could have taken a seat, or at least had a really good chance to. But I took on this challenge because I wanted to change the conversation, and I wanted people to pay attention to these things and that they might not have thought about.
Mm. All right, so assuming people vote with their Bibles and not with their heads, what's next for James Woods?
I've been getting offers to do some interesting things in the future. I've got some speaking engagements that I'm working out the details on, and it remains to be seen. It's interesting and exciting, and I've been able to meet some interesting and people who are doing all kinds of things in advocacy and politics and all that. I do like being in the public arena, it turns out. So I don't think I will be going away from the Arizona political scene anytime soon. So electorally, I don't know. I may get involved with a nonprofit or some sort of group like that. But I do want to try and keep these issues in the public conversation.
Well, if you ever decide to stick with politics and move up here to the New England area, where people are much more receptive to the message, I think you'll have a much better chance.
Yeah, that's I've been told that by friends on both up in the New England area and along the West Coast.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, good luck today, and you never know. Don't write yourself off yet. You never know what could happen.
My speechwriter said, if somehow you do win, just my concession speech, just change, because it talks mostly about what we achieved, just change the first part to about accepting the position, and just deliver it with a face of shock and incredulity. That won't be a problem.
That's good advice.
Mm-hmm.
Good advice. All right, James, thanks so much for being on with us and sharing all this and doing what you do. You mentioned before that you're really paving the way for other non-believers to enter politics and to really have an effect on our government. And I think that out of all the accomplishments, that's certainly one that you deserve to be most proud of. So thank you for that.
I appreciate it. It turns out people, even if they disagree with you, respect honesty. So that's something that people who are getting involved in the political process who don't believe should consider. even if they disagree with you, if you present yourself openly and honestly and aren't antagonistic, we had surprisingly little backlash about me coming out as an open atheist. Every once in a while, I'll get, you know, hate mail about how I'm going to hell or whatever. But mostly people are very supportive. So, because I think most people appreciate the fact that the idea of you can worship however you wish. That's fine. I just want your church to stay out of my government.
Well, I have a secret to share with you, James. You're not going to hell.
I know. I would have to believe it. I have my FFRF member get a hell free card in my wallet. So
that's all you need.
Yep.
You just hand that in to Satan and you're good to go.
Yeah.
All right. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and thanks again, and good luck.
Thank you.
Well, that was Mr. James Woods, an atheist running for Congress. And I can let you know how that actually turned out. He didn't win, which is unfortunate. But he did get 31-point-something% of the vote, which is almost exactly what he predicted based on the demographics of the area. But still, good job, James, and thank you once again for doing what you're doing. Now, we don't normally get to talk about some of the listener feedback that comes in, but this time I want to. Generally, the feedback that comes in is just general, hey, good to hear your show, and thanks for saying this, or just kind of sharing some information with us. But this is something I feel that we should address on the show, because it had to do with last week's episode with Bart Campolo. And we were talking about the Sunday Assembly. And I realized that the dialogue that we had back and forth, there was some editing done there, and we didn't really hear his comments. And I made a comment about the Sunday Assembly saying, yeah, I see how you're reaching a niche that the Sunday Assembly isn't reaching. And I guess one of our listeners not really took offense to it, but was a little bit sensitive to it as somebody promoting the Sunday Assembly, and felt that they are actually doing what Bart is doing, but just not from a preacher standpoint. They're just regular people out there doing this and putting this together. And that makes perfect sense. But what you didn't hear was some of the conversation that went back and forth, and some of the differences that Bart was bringing up with the Sunday Assembly, or some of the things that he saw that were different. And unfortunately, with every episode, I have to cut out at least 5 or 10 minutes just due to length. So that really didn't get in there. But I want to address kind of the key point. And is there a difference between what Bart was talking about and what the Sunday Assembly is actually doing? Well, just to take this question from a practical standpoint, the Sunday Assembly isn't just one thing. There are, as our listener Richard points out, currently there is about 35 new assemblies around the globe, which brings the number to 63. So there are a lot of different assemblies, and it just makes sense that they're not all the same. Now, the difference that I was getting at was the Sunday Assembly seems to be catered towards atheists, towards non-believers, towards agnostics. It seems to actually market towards that demographic specifically. Whereas what we were kind of discussing is going after the people who are still in church, who do not consider themselves non-believers, but don't necessarily appreciate the supernatural and don't buy into it. Maybe it's just part of the package. And I know many people like that. Many of our friends and family and neighbors, it's part of a package deal. And it's, as I think Bart Campolo said in the last episode, that whole supernatural and all these crazy beliefs, it's not what you're actually buying into, but it's the price of admission. And that those are the kind of people that this would be targeting. So you can't really market it as an atheist church or a secular community. It's just more about a community. And just don't talk about the religion. And don't talk about the lack of religion. Just really focus on humanity and humanistic issues. And do it from a secular perspective. And I think that really is the difference that I had in mind. So maybe there are Sunday assemblies that are doing just that, and that would make sense given the sheer number of them out there and the different cultures that each one of them may have. But I don't know. And maybe from the email that I received, maybe they are. So I apologize if I offended any Sunday assembly people. And a special thanks to Richard, who took the time to write a very long email. Well, not very long, but about a couple pages, explaining what he has been up to over at the Sunday Assembly in Charlotte. And a lot of really good stuff there. They're doing some great stuff, and this is fantastic. Keep up the good work, Richard, and everybody else in the Sunday Assembly. And maybe one day soon I could have somebody on from the Sunday Assembly to give us an update and tell us what it's all really about. All right, well, that wraps things up for this episode. You can send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. All right, once again, thank you so much, and we'll see you next week on the Humanist Hour.